from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up on Forum this morning, a new study finds that even moderate alcohol consumption can increase the risk of cancer-related death. We'll hear from one of the study's authors who says alcohol is responsible for some 20,000 cancer deaths each year. The study is not without controversy. Some researchers say alcohol may have certain health benefits and that it's risky to advocate total abstinence. We'll look at the mechanism by which alcohol may increase cancer death, and should you give up booze altogether? Forum is next, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum program. A controversial study was released last Thursday and published in the American Journal of Public Health, presenting the first major analysis in over three decades of alcohol-related cancer deaths. According to the study, alcohol use accounts for 3.5% of U.S. cancer deaths each year among people who consumed more than three alcohol drinks a day, while those who consume 1.5 drinks a day may have accounted for up to a third of those deaths. The study and its results have come under fire, especially from health researchers who argue that alcohol can have various health benefits, and we want to get reaction and analysis this forum hour, not only to the study, but to the debate that has followed on its heels. Joining us for the hour is Kurt Ellison. He is scientific co-director with the International Scientific Forum on Alcohol Research, also a professor of medicine and public health at Boston University School of Medicine, and joins us this morning from Burlington, Vermont. Welcome to the program, Kurt Ellison.
Thank you.
I also want to welcome to the program Christina Clark, who's here with us in studio, research scientist with Cancer Prevention Institute of California, the CPIC. Good morning.
Good morning.
And also want to say good morning to Thomas Greenfield, who is Center Director and Scientific Director with the Alcohol Research Group at the Public Health Institute, one of the authors of this study. He's with us this morning locally from Oakland. Welcome, Thomas Greenfield.
Thank you for having me on the show.
Good to have you. And let me begin with you. These results are based on a couple of national surveys and two different methodologies, but the agreement is pretty close. Can you give us the details?
Yeah, sure. This is a study that basically sought to estimate the amount of mortality that might be owing to alcohol in seven different cancers that for which there's pretty good documentation that alcohol is involved with these cancers. And those ones are cancers of the oral cavity, the pharynx, larynx, esophagus, liver, colon, rectum, and female breast. And as you say, there had not been assessments in recently on this, but we basically took these two national data sets and analyze them in terms of the age and gender breakout of the volume of consumption. And as you may know, there are developed from other studies alcohol attributable fractions for each of the cancers in question. And those were applied to the results from our surveys, and we summed them up. And we also, by the way, looked at the potential years of life lost that would be, sort of attached to the sum of the cancer deaths. And when you do that, you find that roughly 18 years of life per alcohol-attributable cancer is actually involved. So this is a fairly substantial number. It's roughly 19,500 Americans is our finding. Other groups, including the American Cancer Society, have found numbers like 17,000. So it's very similar to some of the other numbers that are in commonly estimated. And basically, these for each of these 19,500 deaths on average, 18 years would be lost by the onset of that cancer.
Now, you mentioned the American Cancer Society, and their recommendation is 2 drinks no more per day for men and 1 for women, and this suggests also a preventative concern. What I'm struck by, and what many are struck by in this study and in that kind of information, is the lack of awareness of connectedness between alcohol consumption and cancer prevention. I mean, we hear so much about tobacco and genetics and obesity, but
right.
Why not alcohol?
Well, and I think it's a good point. Now, it is true that, you know, tobacco involves many more deaths, estimated to be around, 188,000 by the Cancer Society in the U.S., smoking. And, you know, overweight is also estimated to be a large effect as well. So, really, this follows on those larger numbers, but at the same time, it's a substantial number, and to give it some sort of context, that's more deaths from melanoma, and it's more deaths than from ovarian cancer, which get quite a lot of attention. And I think you're absolutely correct, Michael, that there's really not a lot of awareness and not a lot of public awareness, even though, as you know, in California, when you check out at the grocery line, you do see a warning about alcohol causing cancer, because that's required by the state law that is overarching around carcinogens.
Now, in Ireland, they're going to have labels, that alcohol can be cancer-causing throughout the nation. Let me cut to the chase, though, here, in terms of what the heart of the study seems to reveal. It seems to suggest if you drink lower amounts, you diminish your cancer risk. The more consumed, in other words, the more risk you have for different kinds of cancers that you mentioned. And there's controversy over what we mean by moderate drinking. In fact, there was a New York Times article, which many of my listeners may have seen, and I don't know if you're ready. It says, actually, no study has ever proved a casual relationship between moderate drinking and lower risk of death, only that the two often go together. In other words, people are maybe healthier because they drink less.
Yeah, now, the interesting thing here is that, with cancer deaths, it is a dose-response relationship that has been found in numerous studies. And because that line goes through zero and sort of climbs afterwards, there is no sort of clear threshold, which is not to say that the risks aren't very low if you drink very, very modestly. What is true is that when you, for example, the main finding I would say is that if you drink substantially, you will have an increased risk of cancers.
But what mechanism actually does alcohol? By what mechanism does it influence cancer, and does it actually speed up death by cancer, or does it cause
cancer?
Well,
there are several biological mechanisms, although it's one of those areas that still has a lot of active research. Some of them are one of the byproducts of the metabolism in the liver is acetaldehyde, and that itself is a carcinogen. It also produces reactive oxygen or nitrogen species, and it changes the folate mechanism. And for the breast cancer, it looks as though the increase in estrogen concentration may be a factor. And then also,
well, excuse me, that would be because it provides a kind of solvent.
Well, there's also the thought that it might be a solvent
that helps tobacco in other words, yeah.
Smoke and drink, because if you do smoke and drink, the risks, particularly of upper aero respiratory tract cancers, is hugely increased. Some people have found as much as 50 times. This also says that if you have other risk factors, you know, being, in this case, tobacco smoking, you really potentiate the risk tremendously. So that's something that's not widely known either.
Again, that's Thomas Greenfield, who's with us this morning from Oakland locally. He's center director and scientific director of the Alcohol Research Group at the Public Health Institute and one of the study's authors. We're going to hear from a couple of other people about this study, and I want to go to Christina Clark, who's here with us, a studio research scientist with the Cancer Prevention Institute of California. Now, there have been studies here locally, Christina, in terms of breast cancer, specifically over in Marin County, where the rates are high. And what have we learned about alcohol?
Right. So we've done a lot of work to look at alcohol and breast cancer, and breast cancer risk is definitively increased even with moderate alcohol consumption. So I think what we see in this study is certainly a proportion of these cancer deaths, a fairly large proportion, is just due to this very common exposure, which is drinking moderate amounts of alcohol, increasing risk of the number one most common cancer in women. So we've done studies in Marin County, where everyone here in the Bay Area knows we've had very high rates of breast cancer for a long time. And one of the only things that differentiated women who got breast cancer from those who didn't get breast cancer was alcohol consumption. So we know this is an issue for breast cancer. But I think this study, kind of backing up a little bit, really just speaks to this study estimated the proportion of all cancer deaths that we could attribute to alcohol. So we're really saying of the entire cancer burden of this country, how much of that would go away if everybody quit drinking today? And I think the answer was about 20,000 deaths, or about 3.5% of all alcohol. But if you think about it, that's a really different question from what I think many listeners may want to know, which is me. What about me? What's my risk? What should I do? Should I quit? Cut the booze? What should I do? And
well,
I think that's a really different question.
And you say what to that question?
So I think it's a very different question. And I think, sadly, scientists like to address one outcome at a time because that's easy for us. I'm a breast cancer researcher, so I like to look at that one thing at a time. This study kind of gets a little more complicated and looks at all types of cancer. We know that every type of cancer has a very different risk profile. I think probably later in the program we're going to get into heart disease, which is, you know, a major risk to your mortality. So ultimately, I think this really calls out for more information about how to personalize your risk and how to understand for someone like you with your age and sex and family history of different things, how do you learn about what risks you really face and how can you use that information to make choices for yourself?
Well, thanks to our friend Dr. Laura Esserman, we're getting all kinds of data now.
Yes.
And a lot of that data is being brought together and synthesized. But low to moderate drinking has always been linked, at least notionally, to the idea of lower risk of heart disease.
Absolutely. So we see a U-shaped curve, very interesting, with alcohol and heart disease, where abstainers have higher risk of heart disease than people who drink, for women, about one glass a day, and for men, about two glasses a day. And then as alcohol consumption ramps up, we see that risk of heart disease shoot right up. So it's really kind of a U-shaped curve or a J-shaped curve. And it's been a real, the French paradox, you've probably heard of the French paradox. Why do the French have low rates of heart disease yet drink wine? And so there's really a lot of convincing data here that wine is cardioprotective. So it's really kind of stepping back, thinking about how do we manage across all of these health risks and how do we make good choices and what data do we need to do that?
But you know about the research done by Kay Milton Fillmore, a sociologist, again, locally here at the UC San Francisco, doing sociology research through UC San Francisco, says, you know, it's difficult to disentangle what the drinking has to do as opposed to people who maybe drink moderately or drink don't
right.
binge drink and all that, take less risks as far as drinking is concerned, and live a healthy life.
Right. So we call that, is it the drink or is it the drinker? We do know that people who drink alcohol, especially people who drink wine, have, you know, the means to buy wine, have very different just general, you know, demographic and lifestyles than people who don't. You know, the lowest rates of alcohol-related cancers are in Utah because the lowest rates of alcohol consumption are in Utah, and the lowest rates of cancer are in
Utah.
It's
Mormon abstinence, huh?
That's exactly right. So it is very difficult to disentangle these things, and alcohol research is very complicated because we can't do experiments. We can't randomize people to a shot of vodka or not a shot of vodka and see what happens to them.
It's
so we
individual
have to
individual, then, I think is what you're saying, isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, so I'm saying it's all we can really do is observe what we see. We have several large studies in the U.S. The nurses is one that people have heard of. We run one called the California Teacher Study. We have over 133,000 California teachers who fill out questionnaires about their alcohol consumption, and we track what happens to them, and we You know, we cannot sort out whether it's the alcohol or it's just lifestyles that go along with alcohol. We know that alcohol reduces stress. That could be relevant here. So, yeah, it's we have to come up with, you know, good recommendations for people with imperfect data.
Well, before I go to Kurt Ellison, who is highly critical of this study, Thomas Greenfield, I want to go back to you. Are you saying in terms of the conclusions with the study that people should cut out booze?
No, I wouldn't say that. I think the issue is, first of all, it's a personal choice, and, you know, I would be the last to advise on a personal basis. But what we do think is that people, it's worth looking at your own drinking, talking with doctors about it, or your GP, whatever, and considering two things. One is pattern, because we know that pattern has a lot to do with some of these ill effects. For example, I've done a number of mortality studies which show that those people who have, say, five plus drinks on a monthly basis are at elevated risk compared to those equivalent to them in terms of volume who don't. And so we know that even though this particular study did not look at pattern because its focus was otherwise, the people who have higher volumes also tend to have much higher amounts. And even at the, you know, up to 1.5 drinks on average, which, by the way, is quite a large amount by sort of American normative standards. That may not be understood in the West here because that seems sort of normal. But actually, you know, something like, you know, something as much as 80% of men, you know, really, or 20, you know, only about 20% of men actually have more than that. So, you know, very large numbers are drinking very little at all, or drinking nothing. But when you drink even at those low levels, if you have, you know, serious binges or bouts, that is a much worse pattern than drinking very, very evenly, no question. What this says, though, is even if you drink evenly at, say, you know, let's say 1.5, that sort of level, there is a certain risk involved. And it's hard, again, to disentangle how much of this is you know, from the patterns of drinking and how much is from just the alcohol as a carcinogen.
I think this goes to the heart of some of Kurt Ellison's concerns with the study, and I want to bring him into the discussion. He's scientific co-director of the International Scientific Forum on Alcohol Research and professor of medicine and public health at Boston University School of Medicine. And Kurt Ellison, I mean, I guess you've said that you have concern about total mortality in the study, although we've heard Tom Greenfield mention mortality twice, but also concern about mixing drinking and alcoholic abuse with casual drinking, where the risk is small.
Well, I think both Tom and Christine have brought up some interesting points. You know, we've known for years that heavy drinking is associated with these upper aerodigestive, you know, mouth, throat, esophagus, and if you get cirrhosis, liver cancer. So there are a group of truly alcohol attributable cancers. And I think these we don't see in people who have a drink a day. These are people who drink much more. And we've got the, you know, the studies to show that it takes so much alcohol over so long a period. And then there are a few other cancers that are being mixed in this paper, you know, the cancer of the colon and breast in particular. And, you know, they're saying that this we need to bring more attention to alcohol and cancer. And I think that if anybody in America knows about alcohol and cancer, it's about alcohol and breast cancer. I mean, there's been a huge amount of discussion. And, you know, many women are afraid to drink any alcohol because of the worry about developing breast cancer. So I think that these are important points that they're bringing out. And I'm afraid that in this paper, there are a couple of things. First of all, the way that they calculate the intake, they're using alcohol sales and mixing it in with reported intake, according to my interpretation. And I think that, you know, we're not sure that the people who got cancer were drinkers or not. We don't know the individual relationship between alcohol. In our epidemiologic studies and our work in Framingham Heart Study, we've been following people now for more than 60 years. And we know what they report every 2 years or every 4 years in terms of their alcohol. And it's amazing. Most people are pretty consistent. We have some of the heavy drinkers will stop for a while and go back. But generally, the moderate drinkers have been reporting the same amount over many, many years. And when we do that, we can separate the heavy drinkers from the lighter drinkers. And as Tom said, you know, the majority of people do not drink a lot of alcohol. But he also brought up the pattern. And the more and more we look into it, it's not so much the amount, but it's the pattern you drink. You know, we say that, that we're still talking about 14 drinks per week for a man is within the reasonable guidelines according to the recommendations. You know, if you have 14 drinks on one Saturday night or seven on two Saturday nights, that's very different from someone who has one or two drinks on a regular basis. And if you separate these people, I think it's much more likely that you're going to get a truer picture of the relationship between alcohol and cancers.
I have to ask, because I know that there's been some concern about the International Scientific Forum on Alcohol Research, which you're affiliated with, getting funding from many of the institutions that forum members are based at, getting funding from the wine industry, and some actually getting support from the beverage industry for specific projects.
There are 35 international people on our board. First of all, I get no salary support from the beverage industry. I'm strictly living on the Framingham Heart Study Fund from the NIH. And none of the others are paid for their contributions. Now, of the 35, there are seven or eight who work in institutions that have gotten support from the beverage industry in the past or currently. The particular forum itself does not get any funding for salary support from the beverage industry. But I think there are a couple of things that bother me that in this particular study that the authors do not only separate the heavy drinkers, which they should, from the light drinkers, but they include in the lowest category of up to 20 grams per week. Probably, they don't know whether these are ex-drinkers who are reporting zero, alcoholics who have stopped drinking, or whether or not their amount is underestimated or overestimated since they don't have the personal data. And I think that's the advantage of the prospective studies where you know what people have been drinking over many, many years, and you can separate the ex-drinkers, which we are now able to do.
Well, I'd like to certainly hear back from that on Tom Greenfield, but we're coming up on a break, and it's a hard break, and so I want to take this opportunity to invite listeners to join the conversation with any questions or comments you might have, and you can do that now at our toll-free number. You can reach us at 866-733-6786. We do welcome your phone call, so feel free to join the program now. Again, toll-free, 866-733-6786, or email us, forum@kqed.org, or post any of your questions or comments on our website by going to kqed.org/forum and click on this segment. Or you can tweet us, our Twitter handle, @KQED Forum, or you can go to our Facebook page and communicate with us that way. We're talking and we'll continue to talk with Thomas Greenfield, Center Director and Scientific Director of Alcohol Research Group at the Public Health Institute and one of the authors of the study we're focusing our attention on. We also have Christina Clark with us in studio, research scientist with Cancer Prevention Institute of California, the CPIC, and Kurt Ellison with us by phone from Burlington, Vermont, is scientific co-director of the International Scientific Forum on Alcohol Research and professor of medicine and public health at Boston University School of Medicine. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. A new study finds that even moderate alcohol consumption can increase the risk of cancer-related deaths, and we are hearing from one of the authors of that study this hour, Thomas Greenfield, and he says alcohol is responsible for some 20,000 cancer deaths each year. The study is not without controversy. Some researchers say alcohol may have certain not only health benefits, but is risky to advocate total abstinence of. And we're looking at the mechanism by which alcohol may actually increase cancer death and finding out if you should be giving up booze. Our toll-free number is available to you. It's 866-733-6786, or you can email us, forum@kqed.org, or post any of your questions or comments on our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on the segment, or go to our Facebook page or tweet us, our Twitter handle, @KQEDForum. Thomas Greenfield with us, as I said, and so is Christina Clark here in studio, a research scientist with Cancer Prevention Institute of California, and Kurt Ellison with us by phone is scientific co-director of the International Scientific Forum on Alcohol Research and professor of medicine and public health at Boston University School of Medicine. And I'm going to go to your calls here and emails. I just want to get a response, though, from you, Thomas Greenfield, about, well, some of the concerns that were expressed before we went to the break by Kurt Ellison.
Sure. Yeah. So I'd like to say a couple of things. First of all, you know, I've been in the business of survey research in both cross-sectional and longitudinal surveys for roughly 30 years. And we know that surveys do result in underreports of consumption. It's probably quite natural. There's people probably minimize their consumption for a variety of reasons.
I think you might also say they lie about their consumption.
Some lie. We do our very best to say it's a scientific study and there are no consequences and please be open. But people have, in effect, they lie to themselves, you might say. There's a certain amount of denial involved in many cases, particularly in heavy consumption. And so basically one new strategy for overcoming this is to adjust the survey results using basically the functional form of the consumption curve to the sales data, which is, after all, since it's a taxed commodity, it's very reliable. We account in surveys for roughly 50% of the alcohol that's actually sold, and so there are a couple of new strategies. These are the two methodologies we use. They're widely published, and they have been used in many, many studies recently. And so this correction is one of the actual advantages, you might say, of the study. But what I want to emphasize is the takeaway here is basically the big picture, which is that, you know, a comprehensive overall look at these seven different cancers that are well documented as related to alcohol. So it's not the ones that are kind of uncertain. It's the ones that have a well developed track record in terms of being known to be associated with alcohol. And these seven cancers, when you sum them up, you get the numbers, and they actually are very similar to numbers. But I would mention that in Europe, for example, with higher consumption countries, the results have been even higher, quite dramatically, up to 10% for men of cancers. And so our numbers are very much in line with other numbers that have been produced for the U.S. And I think that's the main takeaway, is that this is not it's a refinement of prior studies, and it gives very similar overall results. So I think this strengthens its value, and I would mention that its first author is at the National Cancer Institute, which, after all, is the premier institution for the study. And we also have a colleague at Boston University, Tim Namey, who's the senior author on this. So these are and plus a number of other epidemiologists. So I would just emphasize that this is not out of the ordinary. Not a way out study that's sort of an outlier. It's right in the mainstream.
Do you see it as an outlier, Kurt Ellison?
I have a question, yes, for Tom. How do you know who is drinking this alcohol? I drink, say, 1 to 2 drinks every day, and so I report that, and they relate that to my risk of cancer in an epidemiologic study. But, you're adding a certain amount, I don't know, up to 50%, but to whom do you attribute? This may be the people who develop cancer, or maybe people who do not develop cancer. You cannot tie it with the cancers in the way I understand it. Am I correct?
Well, we actually do, ourselves do mortality studies in which we follow people up who have an individual survey, and we follow them up individually with a National Death Index cause of death. And at least in those studies, it is an individual individual to individual death. But this particular study is you're right. It's a population-wide estimate, and that's its purpose, is basically to give an overall picture and not to focus on the individual.
So, let me bring you in here, Tina Clark. I mean, particularly in terms of the concern that this is, well, I mean, we've already heard Tom Greenfield say what the takeaway is here, and seems to corroborate, at least in his mind and these other researchers that he worked with, that it gives more credence.
Yeah, so this, again, I think this study was designed to give us a flavor of the proportion of cancer that's attributable to alcohol. And again, if we took alcohol away today and we went back to prohibition, how much would we expect to see our cancer mortality rate drop? And the answer they came up with was 3.5%. Very, very different question than I think what we were kind of getting into, which is how do we estimate risk? How do we understand the influence of other risk factors? How do we study alcohol's risk on various health outcomes, including cancer? And the answer to that is we do these long-term prospective studies where we can really track what happens to drinkers and heavy drinkers and moderate drinkers over time.
And we do know that alcohol and cancer are associated, as Tom Greenfield has been saying, in men to a larger degree with mouth, larynx, esophageal, and pharynx cancer, and in women with breast cancer. And I want to go back to that just for a moment before we bring in our callers, because you alluded to it earlier. Higher in women who often don't get enough folate in their diets, from what we know, but we've got this figure of 15% higher breast cancer deaths in women related to alcohol. Where do we come to that?
So that's, again, just saying this is the most common cancer in women, and this is a very common exposure in women. And so it makes sense that a reasonable proportion of breast cancer deaths are attributable to alcohol. But we know from the prospective studies that, yes, it is a risk factor for breast cancer, especially in postmenopausal women whose ovaries are no longer producing hormones. We think alcohol has this influence on hormone levels such that breast cancer risk is slightly elevated. So again, with that population perspective and thinking about what's happening broadly in the United States, it's a very common exposure, and it's a very common outcome, and it's it sure makes sense to me that there is a significant number of breast cancers that would go away if women quit drinking today. But that's not going to happen.
We haven't talked about total mortality. I mean, that's the bottom line. And, you know, our calculations. Can I comment on this?
Yeah, Kurt Ellison, I'd mentioned total mortality before. I know that's a concern to you, so please go ahead.
The epidemiological data suggests that if we have a 55 or 60-year-old woman at typical risk of breast cancer, in other words, she does not have a mother or a sister, she's not at really high risk, and if she stops one drink a day because she's scared by this paper, and there are a lot of headlines in the news I'm just looking at that don't say decrease alcohol, but cease alcohol. If she stops, she would probably have, 5 or 10% lower risk of breast cancer over the following few years. However, her risk of dying from a heart attack or a stroke, which are 9 times more common than breast cancer deaths, would go up by more than 20%. So actually, if she stopped one drink a day so that she would avoid breast cancer, she would not live as long. It's very clear that moderate drinkers live longer and have less disability as they age than non-drinkers. And even when we take into consideration make sure they're not ex-drinkers and other lifestyle factors. So I think it is important that you not take this cancer risk into isolation, but fit it in, as Tina suggested, into the overall pattern of lifestyle.
All right, let me bring our callers in. And Kathy, join us, please. You're on the air.
Oh, hi. I'm really enjoying your show. I'm a psychologist practicing in Burlingame. And I'm just seeing an increase in just the younger crowd drinking, an increase in, I think, what I consider to be an epidemic in San Francisco of alcohol abuse, alcohol dependence, and a lot of these young adults have no idea about the risks in their drinking. I'm just, I do a lot of education when I do my treatment. I specialize in addictions. I'm just seeing that there's just such an increase in drinking behavior all the way around, and I've been practicing for 25 years. I'm just wondering if your wonderful panel can comment on that, and also how do we get the word out to these young people about the risks that they're taking by drinking, of course, not only to their health, but to the psychological effects that we're seeing also with lifestyle factors, with the addiction of speed in Silicon Valley. It's just getting out of control.
Go to Tina Clark here in studio. Tina.
So, yeah, those are all important issues. I think just bringing it back to alcohol and cancer, we don't know a lot, as the other panelists have said, about patterns of drinking and whether binge drinking as a young person influences cancer risk differently from moderate drinking in adults. So that's definitely a gap that we need to understand, how patterns of drinking across the lifespan influence health and influence cancer risk. But one thing we know about alcohol consumption is that it actually tracks pretty closely to socioeconomic status. So here in the Bay Area, where people tend to have, pretty good incomes, good lifestyles, we have the extra income to go to the wine store. So that may be partly why we have higher consumption here in the Bay Area.
And let me thank Kathy for the call and bring on Rebecca as our next caller. Good morning.
Good morning. I think this kind of question is often dismissed, but I would bet that there's a pretty real connection between alcohol-related cancers and the huge amounts of pesticides and herbicides and petroleum-based fertilizers used on vineyards. I have a friend who just bought a vineyard, and she said she would probably, she's thinking of stopping her wine consumption because of, and she said it's very hard to grow organic, but I wonder if there's a big connection.
Rebecca, I'm glad you brought that up. In fact, I'm looking at an email here from Whitney who says, I'm curious if any of the research has looked at organic wines versus wines produced with pesticides. I live in Sonoma County, and I'm very concerned about the amount of pesticides used in the production of wine, both in the runoff and consumption. Can you shed some light here, Thomas Greenfield? Thomas Greenfield?
Yeah, so, I mean, one thing that is clear is that these risk factors do interact. And, you know, so I would say, these are reasonable concerns. Of course, there really isn't the hard research that I know of, anyway, on this very point. But if you get and if you believe in the label and you can purchase organic wine, maybe that's a way to go for somebody who has those concerns. And certainly, it'd be great if the industry moved in that direction. For sure. If you live, close to a factory producing toxic output, that's another risk factor. So definitely we would want to be concerned about that.
And Tina Clark, you wanted to add something here?
Yeah, one really interesting thing about alcohol and health research we've observed is, in general, there seems to be very little difference in the type of alcohol consumed. So beer, liquor, wine, which is really interesting and kind of for... as a scientist, pulls me into what is the biological mechanism of what alcohol is doing. But clearly, additional things in alcoholic beverages, pesticides, other contaminants is a data gap that, to my knowledge, very few studies have addressed.
Kurt Ellison, let me give you kind of a broad question here in connection with all the concerns that have been brought up about factors relating with one another, tobacco and pesticides and so forth. Because I'm not exactly a teetotaler by any stretch, but my father used to say to me, drinking booze is like taking poison into your system. And, you know, we know enough at this point to know it does damage the body tissue. It actually is tough on mucous membranes. You can go on with all sorts of effects that alcohol has. So I get back to a question I asked you earlier. Is this study an outlier study, or does this corroborate a lot of things that we've known before about the toxicity of alcohol?
The data that were used were, are the ones we've all seen. The assumptions that kind of bothered some of us were the calculation of disappearance data of alcohol and calculating it as far as effects on cancer. But basically, the thing that kind of bothers me is that the headlines generated by this type of paper that is kind of a scare paper. You know, I'm looked through the internet this morning. Alcohol is a major factor. It's a big role. Drink a day increases cancer. Alcohol causes cancer. This is from the marijuana group.
And they I blame the media more than the study.
Alcohol causes, I know, the media, they go crazy on this type of thing. And the problem is that the little old lady who is having one drink a day or one every other day is frightened and quits. And we know that this is not in her best health interest. The people who are drinking, boozing huge amounts pay no attention to this. So I think it's important that we get a clear and balanced message out to the public. And I think that is that if you don't consume alcohol, fine. If you do it, you should know what's the safe way to do it. It's like driving. You know, we're not going to ban driving because it causes a lot of 50,000 deaths a year. We're going to teach people how to drive safely. And we should be starting early to teach people, if they decide they're going to consume alcohol, how to do it safely, small amounts on a regular basis.
Well, and Thomas Greenfield, I'm looking at a listener, Iris's comments here. Well, actually, she says, I'm not just not finding this alcohol cancer link to be convincing at all yet. Can you say something about how you were able to control for smoking and for stress and depression, which are also correlated with both cancer incidence and alcohol consumption? How were you able to control for these?
Well, we do, of course, control for those, particularly in the individual studies. You know, this is very much part of the work we do, is to introduce control factors. And what is true is that we do find that both there's a volume effect and there is a pattern effect on mortality. And I would add that one thing that is very clear in the global statistics and also for the U.S. is that young people's drinking, if we go back to the comment from one of the listeners, youth drinking has perhaps the highest rates of risk are around injuries. And, of course, then you get tremendous, if the injuries are either disabling or they are expensive to remedy for the society, or else somebody dies. And then you have many years of life lost and earnings lost and so forth. So for young people, that's the largest risk, as well as risks of suicide and homicide and, you know, other kind of associated risks that are very different from the long-term chronic consumption kind of risks.
And again, Thomas Greenfield is Center Director and Scientific Director of the Alcohol Research Group at the Public Health Institute and one of the authors of this study. And Jeff joins us as our next caller. Jeff, you're on. Good morning.
Hi. I thought this was about cancer. I'm hearing something different now. But, you know, I think that there's a leap of faith being made with the data. For instance, until you know the effect of a healthy lifestyle or a glass of wine with dinner or two, this data is incomplete. We know, for instance, now that taking a baby aspirin has a wide-ranging effect on a whole range of different cancers. And so until things like that are factored in, I think making a declarative statement alcohol causes cancer is declaring something that isn't fully understood yet. And that, I think that's what I have to add.
Okay. We thank you for your
opinion. I would just say that there are many case control studies in which all these confounding factors are, held constant, in which it's clear there's a dose response kind of situation here. I think the debate is probably around at what level do you become concerned about this. And I do take Curtis Ellis's point that it's an individual issue and it relates very much to the age of the individual and the gender of the individual and also the other risk factors. So all those things come into play when you do actually try to, bring this to the level of the individual. But from the point of view of the nation and the public health takeaway here is that we haven't been giving a lot of attention to this. And yet, obviously, there's a lot of research going on in melanoma, as there should be. There's a lot of research going on in relation to ovarian cancer. And yet this contribution from alcohol to cancers is actually greater in number than those cancers. So that's to say, we need to attend to this more. We need to have more public health messaging around it. And it needs to be something that gets discussed on an individual basis by doctors and patients.
There still are, however, a lot of questions looming and a lot more need for additional research. Tina Clark, I'm thinking, for example, of when Thomas Greenfield mentioned risk in general. There's a risk of developing, if you have cancer, if you're diagnosed with cancer, a new cancer that one can assume from this or one can extrapolate from this. And I'm also wondering, getting back to breast cancer for a moment, after you're treated for breast cancer, if there's a risk of recurrence, because actually alcohol can increase levels of estrogen, that has to be factored in, doesn't it?
Absolutely. So second cancers, we are now doing a lot of research to understand what kind of lifestyle changes cancer survivors can make to influence, to reduce their risk of developing a second cancer. And there's a lot of research looking at smoking, drinking, and exercise and all of the things we know influence health generally. And yes, in breast cancer survivors, whether or not to resume alcohol drinking and how that may influence recurrence, particularly of a hormone-sensitive tumor, is a hot topic. And I wish I could say we had answers, but I assure you that that research is ongoing. But let me say, too, back to Jeff, the caller who came in and said, I don't buy this. This is a very difficult thing to study. We cannot do experiments here. We can't random. It's ethically impossible and practically impossible to randomize people to drinking and finding out what happens to them. But that being said, we do these very long-term studies. We really do try to adjust for all these things that callers have thought of and brought up about diet and depression and stress and these things. We do the very best job we can do, and we do have many, many long-term studies that are showing the same thing, and that is that there is an increased risk of breast cancer and certainly an increased risk of these heavy drinking cancers we've discussed, and a lower risk of heart disease and a lower risk of overall mortality, and that's fascinating.
And we're getting some fascinating responses here. Let me read some of the emails that are coming in. Matt writes, so I'm hearing booze may contribute to a small percentage of cancer, and I'm assuming by contribute you mean add some small amount of risk. Booze has many other health and behavior issues that are far more damaging and widespread. Why bother focusing on such a minor link? Peggy writes, in thinking about the individual risk, listeners need to remember that the important number to understand is how alcohol raises or lowers their absolute risk of contracting cancer. So if drinking two glasses of wine a day raises your risk of dying of breast cancer by 15%, but your risk of dying of the disease was only 3% to begin with, it may not be such a relevant figure. While this research is important on a policy level, on a personal level, it's important that every individual understands his or her own risk. And Tony writes, one of the guests said, we can't sort out lifestyle effects from the effects of alcohol. If they can't do that, they should get more data until they can sort it out. Well, what data do we need here? Let me go to you on this, Kurt Ellison.
I think if you look at epidemiologists, they're all bald or very little hair because they pull their hair out, trying to make sure that they're measuring just the effects of the alcohol consumption rather than social class or income or education or smoking and everything else. But, you know, we've been doing this for 30 years now, and many of the earlier problems where they were grouping in ex-drinkers with non-drinkers have been taken care of. And when you narrow it down to lean, healthy, exercising people on a good diet, it turns out that if they also have a little bit of alcohol, their risk of coronary disease drops another 60%. So in other words, you can cut your risk in half by being lean and exercise and not smoking, all of these things. But if you also happen to have a little bit of alcohol with it, your risk is dropped even further.
And so Curtis, wouldn't you agree that the kind of recommended, if you want, dose in that case would probably be something like a drink a day or something of that sort?
Absolutely.
There's no need to have a large quantity to achieve that result, right?
Absolutely. A drink a day will give you almost all of the benefits.
And I think that's really consistent here in the sense
A drink a day will keep the doctor away, as we used to say about an apple a day?
When we talk about reduction, you know, if you actually look at the individuals who have the levels that we're looking at in our paper, that is to say where most of the cancers come from, which is above 1.5 drinks a day, on average, those people are drinking very often in a very fluctuating level. They're drinking small amounts some days, large amounts other days. Very few Americans drink evenly at the levels that are recommended.
Excuse me, Dr. Greenfield, we're coming toward the end of the program here, and I need to ask you, I mean, there is a good deal of ambiguity to this word moderate and what constitutes moderate drinking, isn't there?
Well, yes, that's true. And if you look at different countries have different guidelines, for example, in some countries like Australia have recently reduced their guidelines based on looking at 100-year likelihood, which is done for sort of toxics. I'm not sure I think that's the best way to approach it. But even in our cases, you know, it's basically recommended that you have an even low drinking pattern, not a wildly varying one.
Well, that's going to have to conclude us here, but I want to extend thanks to all of you, and thanks, Thomas Greenfield, for joining us. They can read the study online, I believe.
Yes, they can.
And you want to give that website?
It's at the American Journal of Public Health, and they could also contact me, tgreenfield at arg.org.
Okay, and we'll try to get that information on our website. Thanks to Tina Clark, who joined us in studio here with the CPIC, and thanks to Kurt Ellison of Boston University School of Medicine. And thanks to you, our listeners. We wouldn't be here without you. I want to also extend thanks to all of those work behind the scene here. Forums produced by Judy Campbell and Irene Noguchi, with help this week from Katie Sprenger, and we also want to thank our engineer, Danny Bringer, our senior editor, Dan Zoll, executive producer, Raul Ramirez. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation, and by a generous gift from Jan Schrem and Maria Minetti Schrem, who believe that all people deserve access to education, information, and culture for a lifetime of exploration and learning.